Hello everyone, here is session 9 of the International Relations and European Integration class, and today's topic is terrorism. And to do so, I will start out with presenting some approaches that explain asymmetric warfare, because terrorism is one aspect of asymmetric warfare. Next week, or in the next session, I will present then something on so-called one-sided violence, massacres, genocide, which is often also another instance of asymmetric violence. I will, in the second part, then talk about theoretical approaches that help us to understand terrorism. And here, the deterrence model of terrorism is particularly important. I will also say something about suicide and terrorism. And the last part is about different explanations of terrorism, like, for instance, poverty, and then counter-terrorism. What can be done against terrorism, and what kind of implication does this have for our societies? Terrorism, or terror of military units, be it by the state or rebels, has played an important role in the arts, but obviously also in political discussion. Particularly grisly are the sketches by Goya, the French painter of the 18th and 19th century, who was deeply depressed by what he experienced during the Napoleonic Wars. Quite typical for this is this artistic contribution is the question of whether or not these acts of barbarism can be understood through the lenses of rational action. So, and this is comes also into play in the title for the whole series of sketches, With or Without Reason. Obviously, some of these acts, terrorist acts, massacres, are spontaneous. But most often these spontaneous acts are relatively small. So to understand massive forms of terrorism, terrorist campaigns or massacres, one needs to look at who are the perpetrators. And what is particularly important here is that one distinguishes those who perpetrate the actions and those who order the actions. And this is then typically done through the lenses of principal agent reasoning. So the organizers, the chiefs of the terrorist organizations, are the principals, and the agents are the perpetrators whom they hire for a specific mission. So what we have here is, again, an instrumental understanding of political violence. Terrorism has to be explained as a form of asymmetric warfare. So you have a David and you have a Goliath out there. And to understand this, one can also look at the modes, the types of attacks that terrorists then use, or rebel movements if they are relatively strong. So they rely quite often on guerrilla tactics. Quite often when you look at what the government does in response, they try to hide that they ordered such actions. So they delegate the dirty work of massacres, of state terrorism, quite often to militias. And rebels have also a division of labor, so quite typically if you look at Hamas, for instance, in the Middle East, there is a political wing, but there is also a military wing. Quite often there is a close overlap between these different parts of these organizations. So obviously throughout the centuries we have found different cases of asymmetric warfare. Just think about what comes to your mind. Then is expressed through the thinking about this. So asymmetric warfare already played a role in strategic thinking, like for instance in the thinking of Sun Tzu, a Chinese philosopher of warfare, before Jesus Christ was born. So, and what is important here is asymmetric information, that the weaker side tries to give the impression that it is not as strong as it is, that it tries to evade the other side and engages in hit and run attacks. And you see it here, pretend to be weak, that he may grow arrogant. One particular instance of asymmetric warfare, or one war where asymmetric warfare was quite common, was the Vietnam War. So it's not surprising that Henry Kissinger, the historian turned politician, foreign minister of the United States, was thinking about this. And Mao, the leader of the Communist Party, the revolutionary in China, was also thinking about that because he was leading a successful terrorist campaign. So how do such acts then quite typically look? So here to the left you have one example from German history. In the beginning of World War I, the German government, under the leadership of Kaiser Wilhelm II, engaged into asymmetric warfare and killed hundreds of Belgian civilians. Belgium was then a neutral state, but Germany used the territory in the hope to beat then France. Obviously, also other rebel movements than the Viet Cong from the Vietnam War relied on this tactic, like for instance the Zionist groups that fought against Great Britain in the War of Independence for Israel. A particularly brutal terrorist attack was conducted against the King David Hotel in Jerusalem. Modern thinking about asymmetric warfare is again influenced by Tom Schelling. And you know Tom Schelling from his contribution to deterrence theory, to the crisis bargaining models that I introduced in earlier sessions. And he formalized this as through the notion of the power to hurt. So the weaker side does not engage into a full-fledged military campaign, but it tries to hurt the other side where it is weakest. And why does it do so? Because it tries to obtain concessions from the other side. So this is again the instrumental understanding, but it's also quite useful for understanding what terrorist organizations try to obtain. They try to obtain a concession from the other side, meaning a specific government. So think, for instance, here, ISIS in Syria tries to obtain concession, meaning territory in this particular case. Through this lenses, these attacks are nothing else than a bargaining process. Okay, it's quite controversial of whether or not then these actions are successful. There is a historical study by Ari Gwynne Toft, first an article in International Security, later on also a book published with Cambridge University Press, and he claims that over the decades, and you see this at the bottom left here, when you look at asymmetric conflicts, the weak actor has become increasingly successful, and in the second half of the 20th century, it was even more successful than the strong actor. He makes an argument that the success then depends on whether or not the two sides engage into the same sort of strategy, meaning on whether the strong actor, most often the government, relies on military campaigns or then on terror strategies, which are here described as barbarism. The weak actor then can try to defend itself in this military engagements, but it can also in return rely on these guerrilla tactics that I have described beforehand. And if the choice here is different from the two sides, according to Araguin Toft, then the other side will win. So if the government relies on military campaigns and the other side, the rebels, rely on guerrilla warfare, then they have a chance of winning this particular confrontation. This is a little bit, well, sounds a little bit simplistic, and it also is quite simplistic, but it gives you an impression that one obviously has to always look when you study terrorism, that you have to look at the interaction between the two sides and how the government reacts to the confrontation from the other side. And this immediately leads then to terrorism, which I will now first describe and define. One of the most important terrorist researchers is Todd Sandler from the University of Texas at Dallas, and he has introduced a definition of terrorism that I will now read out. Terrorism is the premeditated use or threat of use of violence by individuals or subnational groups to obtain a political or social objective through intimidation of a large audience beyond that of the immediate victims. So, the ones who are killed are not the ones that are necessarily the ones that whose attention one tries to get. Typically, one wants to terrify the entire population. One wants to terrify the government and hopes then for a concession, meaning, for instance, that they engage into formal negotiations, release prisoners, and so on. But quite often, this is obviously not the case. What you also see here on this slide is that the literature, and especially Todd Sandler, distinguishes between transnational and domestic terrorism. Transnational terrorism is terrorism conducted by perpetrators from one state. Think about 9/11, and perpetrators coming from Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and other Arabic countries, but the attack is conducted on foreign soil, meaning in this particular case in the United States, in Washington, D.C., and in New York. Okay, what you also see here, but also then on other slides that will follow later on, that terrorism has evolved over time and it has become deadlier. But there are other considerations that one needs to consider. What is important here is that we can distinguish different strategies. And according to Kitt and Walter, one needs to look at who the primary audience is. Is it then the enemy population, the enemy government, for instance, or does one try to win through certain acts of terrorism the support of the own population, the own ethnicity, the own religious group, the own ideological group, for instance. And terrorism always relies on uncertainty, because if there is no uncertainty, then all terrorist attacks would obviously fail. So these are always, when they are effective, they are always surprising events. And these two dimensions, the subject of uncertainty and the target of persuasion, is then used by Kitt and Walter to develop certain ideal types of terrorism, which I will define at least some of them here on this slide here. In general, terrorism is a coercive act. So it's part of a bargaining process. You try to obtain a concession. The same is the case, for instance, for economic coercion, meaning economic sanctions. Some terrorist acts try to provoke a certain action by the target government. Whether the reaction, for instance, of the US government after 9/11, of the attack of Afghanistan, was the intended action, we do not know, but it was a strong and powerful action, although it was in the end obviously not a successful one. So there is an aspect of provocation here. If there are, for instance, negotiations going on between the Palestinians or some factions of the Palestinians and the Israeli government, then radicals try to spoil these signs of cooperation. So certain terrorist acts can be understood under the heading of spoiling. What is also important when you compare terrorist organizations that try to convince the same supporters or potential supporters is that they act like companies who try to have a larger share of a particular market. And this strategy has been described as outbidding. So outbidding means that one group, for instance ISIS, becomes more and more violent to become the more influential actor over time. Okay, so these are the basic strategies that are used by a terrorist organization. Let me now move a little bit to the descriptive side. What do we see just in the data that have been assembled by Todd Sandler and his co-authors, but also by other groups? So what you see here when you look at the end of the 1960s up to the end of the 2010s is that the number of people who are killed in a terrorist incident has grown over time. So to a certain extent, although this sounds cynical, you can say that terrorist attacks have become more effective. And you see this also when you look at this in relative terms, upper right figure, that the proportion of national and domestic terrorist events with casualties have both grown over time. And so this is not a bombing like, for instance, the Irish Republican Army quite often conducted, where you send a note 5 minutes before the bomb goes up that the bomb is exploding soon. These are surprising events, and the terrorists obviously know that there is a high risk that some people will die. What is also interesting is that when you look at what kind of types of attacks, modes of attacks the terrorist organizations rely on, is that transnational terrorist organizations have relied more frequently on bombings up to 9/11, and since then bombing is still important, but to a lesser extent. What has grown in much more in importance is hostage taking for this type of organizations and armed attacks. When you look then at domestic terrorism, then you see partly a reverse development, that bombings have grown, relatively speaking, in importance, also hostage taking, but assassinations have declined. And I will come back to this. What you also see at, in the upper figures, is that you have certain cycles, and I will explain these cycles then in the second part of this session. Let's move then to how these terrorist organizations have evolved also with regard to ideology. What you see here is that in general religious group have grown, or fundamentalists have grown in importance over time. And left-wing terrorism is no longer that important, but right-wing terrorism is relatively stable. So let's then move to how lethal terrorist organizations are. And what you see here is that religious groups are more lethal. So they kill more than other types of groups. And you have also indirectly seen this on previous slides. Since religious fundamentalists have grown in importance, this explains then also why there is an increasing number of people killed through the average terrorist incident around the world. Okay, so not surprising is another descriptive finding of Sandler and his co-authors in this article, that larger groups conduct more attacks and left-wing groups conduct less deadly actions than right-wing groups. Okay, what you see here, and when you look through at terrorist organizations through market lenses, then you see that some of these firms, these organizations, die out relatively quickly, and other ones are more successful and can sustain a terrorist campaign over longer periods of time. So what you see here is that it depends on whether or not the top leader of the group is killed or not. Quite often these organizations then also die out if the top guy is arrested or killed. Think about the Bader Meinhof factions, the fall of 1977, the former leaders or the leaders who were imprisoned of the Red Army factions committed suicide in Stuttgart, Stammheim. There were some successors to this, the second, third, and fourth generations of the Red Army factions, but these groups have been less successful, and at some point then the last remaining successor of this left-wing terrorist organization formally gave up. So one can also explain the ups and downs of individual terrorist organizations. I want you to think relatively quickly about what are the goals of organizations as diverse like the Red Army faction. And you see here Gudrun Ensslin and Andreas Bader. Sometimes the group is also called the Bader Meinhof gang, although Ulrike Meinhof, a journalist turned terrorist, was not as influential then for the operations as Gudrun Ensslin was. Simultaneously, you should, based on the categories that I have introduced, also think about what the audiences of this kind of organizations are. And then thirdly, think about why religious fundamentalists kill more people than, for instance, left-wing movements. Let's now look at theoretical approaches that help us to understand terrorist events, and then I will also say something here about suicide terrorism. How can we understand suicide terrorism? Okay, as I've mentioned previously, one can look at terrorist strategies, terrorist campaigns as acts that are part of a bargaining process. And this also explains why some people like Todd Sandler have used the deterrence logic to study the interaction between the terrorist groups and the governments which react to them. So what governments typically then try to do is that they introduce specific measures which makes it harder for the terrorist to conduct their actions. And there can be either preemption, meaning that you try to prevent certain terrorist acts from being conducted, like for instance through the arrest of terrorist leaders or through the killing of terrorist leaders or through drones or other means, or then less proactive, that you rely on a simple cost-benefit calculus and you try to defend yourself more strongly to increase the costs for the other side. And through these interactions, you can derive certain hypotheses and which help you then understand what you observe in the data. So the first one I've already shown. So through the deterrence model, you can understand why there is a cyclical nature of terrorist activities. So you see a surge in terrorist attacks, and then you see a decline. You see the surge until the government reacts, increases the price. The terrorist organizations are then less effective, but they will eventually take up their campaign again and then rely potentially on other means. So what you have here, this is the third hypothesis here, are substitution effects. Once it becomes no longer possible to skyjack airplanes like Al-Qaeda did on 9/11 in 2001, then they rely on other strategies, like, for instance, by attacking then railway stations, or by bombing trains, or by relying on rifle assaults simultaneously. So terrorist organizations try to reach their goals to create as much terror as possible by minimizing the costs they have for the individual action here. And important is here that you always distinguish between the perpetrators and the organizers of these particular acts of violence. Okay, related to this is also the second hypothesis here, which is the weakest link thesis. And this thesis means nothing else than that terrorist organization observe a certain network of states that try to defend themselves against terrorist attacks, and then they pick the government with the weakest counter-terrorist measure. And I will give you an illustration of this just in some minutes. Obviously, when you engage into counter-terrorism, then this has implications for the populations, for the citizens of these countries, and this can curtail civil liberties, and there is a trade-off, and societies have to decide how large, how far-reaching these measures should be, something which I will also explain later on. So here's just, once again, the cycles that that you observe here when you look at, for instance, stopped or completed acts. There is an up and down, and according to the deterrence model, you can explain this quite easily through changing cost and benefit calculus for the terrorist organization, given shifts in counter-terrorist measures. The substitution logic is perhaps the most interesting hypothesis, and it was established through a pioneering studies, a study by Walter Anders and Todd Sandler in the American Political Science Review already quite some time ago. So what they analyzed were different types of attacks: skyjackings, hostage takings, assassinations, and so on. And given the increased number of skyjackings in the 1960s, 1970s, metal detectors were introduced at airports. Something obviously you know from your own experience. And you see here in the second column that through the introduction of these metal detectors, the numbers of skyjackings has gone down. But what has increased simultaneously is hostage takings and assassinations. So terrorist organization, in response to deterrence measures, shift to other modes of attack. The illustration of the weakest link thesis, something that I've promised to you to illustrate this. A typical example that you could use here is, are the bombings in Nairobi and Dar el Salaam in Tanzania, aiming at the United States, so some loosely allied states instead of the United States were attacked. The United States were then only attacked 3 years later directly. So one goes for the weakest chain in the network here. The same logic also obviously applies for counter-terrorist measure. One tries to identify the weakest terrorist within a particular network. And then given this information, one tries to destroy a certain network by aiming at the contacts of this weakest member of a particular group. This is the weakest link hypothesis. Let's move then to how can we understand suicide attacks. And here, again, it has to be distinguished between who are the perpetrators and who are the ones who order certain attacks. And the ones who order certain attacks, they choose then specific volunteers or not so volunteers for particular actions. And after the Second Intifada, Ben Melich and Berebe conducted a study where they tried to figure out who was chosen for what particular kind of attack. So when you look in general here and only, for instance, at the successful suicide bombings, then education as such has a negative impact on the number of killed. But if you look then also at the importance of the target, then you see here that the interaction of age and target increases the death toll of particular suicide terrorist attacks. And so what you see here is that age together with target and education together with target has this positive impact. And you see this in the third column, for instance. What does this mean is that then if the attack is a particularly important one, if the target is an important one, then the terrorism organizers, they choose older or they choose more highly educated terrorists because they can be more, they can be, have the more certainty in this instant that their attacks will then be successful in the wrecked mind of the terrorist organization, meaning that more people are killed or injured. If you look at suicide terrorism over time, then you see an increase. There were also in ancient histories certain suicide terrorist attacks. But in more modern times, you see suicide terrorism in the 1980s in Sri Lanka, in Lebanon, and then an increase largely in the Middle East. Michael Horowitz has analyzed this, and he concludes that this strategy will be here for the coming decades, simply because terrorists now know that this is relatively successful instrument. So they rely on an instrument that is hard to deter. Let me now move to the causes of terrorism. And here one can distinguish explanations looking at the individual perpetrators, the organizations that conduct this, and here especially the principal agent relationship between the organizers and the perpetrators is important, and then structural approaches. So you look at a certain country, domestic terrorism, level of grievances, authoritarianism, poverty have been explanations that are particularly important in this context. And I will come back to some of them later on. What is important to note is that individual approaches, individual explanations have largely failed. So if you look at the psychological background of terrorists, this doesn't lead you anywhere. There might be certain weaknesses in this study, but here one doesn't see any kind of relationship that is then robust over different studies. And this has been described or analyzed quite convincingly by Jeff Viktorov in an article in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, saying that also quite some of the hypotheses that have been put forward can simply not be tested. So in order to understand terrorism, you have to look either at the strategic level or at the organizational level. And this is what we will do after the mini break, and look at socio-demographic factors and try to figure out why do they not explain much in the variants that we will find. Welcome back again. Last part of this session, and I will look at particular sets of explanations for terrorism. And I will start out here with the popular explanation that poverty is a root cause of terrorist attacks. And I choose this particular explanation because it was so popular among politicians, and an unlikely supporter of this particular thesis was George W. Bush. We fight against poverty because hope is an answer to terror. So, linking anti-poverty strategy with counter-terrorist strategies. So, the question then is whether this is really the case or not. And this particular thesis was rejected by the late Alan Krueger, an economist at Princeton University, who has looked that then at the second intifada to look at the background of the perpetrators. And what he found, and this you see in the figure here to the right, is then that suicide bombers are more highly educated than the average population in Palestine at this period of time. And he takes this as a rejection of the validity of the claim by George W. Bush. So, and he also finds support then from other data, for instance, looking at opinion polls on who supports Hezbollah or not, or by looking in general at the background of then terrorists. And he always finds that terrorists are not a random sample of the overall population. They rather come from the middle class and quite often have then a college degree. Although there is evidence in favor of the thesis that poverty is not a root cause of terrorism, I do not find this particular explanation that convincing, because it does not look at the organizational level. And this we have seen also in the study about suicide, terrorism, that terrorist organization pick certain individuals for certain actions, and they only recruit certain parts of the populations. And quite often, if a certain organization is popular, you have an oversupply of volunteers for the terrorist actions. If one takes them into account this labor market dynamic, so to speak, then this counter thesis by Alan B. Krueger has to be rejected itself. So in the literature, grievances are important, but perhaps not necessarily economic grievances, but then political grievances. And one scholar who has looked at this over the years in various studies is James Piazza. Here is a macro economic examination covering 16 years, where you see here tries to explain the number of incidents, the number of casualties here across countries through economic variables, demographic variables and political variables. And you see here that rather the demographic variables, and this is quite trivial, more populous states experience more terrorist incidents, play a role, and then political grievances like an increase in repression. But you see then also here is a more refined study based on a game theoretic model. And like in the studies on the civil democratic peace, you see here a curvilinear effect. So you have the highest number of terrorist events when you look at the level of democracy in these countries, and these are measured here through the Polity Index. If you look at the level of democracy, then typically anarchists are the countries which experience the highest number of terrorist incidents. Why is this the case? Sandler and his co-authors develop here a model where they look at different factors that offer then a specific trade-off for countries. So there are here relatively few opportunities for individuals in autocracies. So, and simultaneously, grievances exist, but the state is strong in autocracies and can fight against this challenge that might come. In anocracies, so the political systems in between autocracies and democracies, the strategic opportunities increase, grievances then still exist, and in democracies, obviously, there are other means then to express your grievance, and potentially there is also more likely a solution to be found for addressing these particular grievances. So this leads then to this curvilinear effect here. So repression is important, but especially then in anocracies and not in auto crisis. Let's move then to our understanding of counterterrorism. I already said that we need to distinguish between preemption and then deterrence. And preemption is a proactive strategy relying on military means in the short run, but you can also think about here foreign aid that you go to the terrorist organization, potential terrorists, and you try to re-educate them. And through this, you prevent that these potential terrorists conduct acts in the future. Simultaneously, you can rely on conventional deterrence mechanisms that I have introduced beforehand. But here, Sandler and Ockre have done is just to make it an analysis on whether we will see preemption or then deterrence, and they make an argument that this follows an extended prisoner's dilemma logic, that you will end up with an oversupply of deterrence measure, because there is always an incentive to rely on what the other side does, which leads then to this prisoner's dilemma logic, and states then rely on these passive measures to a great extent, and quite some of these measures obviously come late after a new wave of terrorist incidents. Okay, what do we find here then in the empirical literature? There are some American scholars who have analyzed here then the effectiveness of military means, and in this case, drone strikes, on whether drone strikes, sometimes openly declared by the US military, sometimes not. To do so in Pakistan is something difficult, obviously, but there is information about these drone strikes, and they come to a positive conclusion that which you also see here in the figures. So the more drone strikes a certain part of Pakistan experienced, the fewer militant attacks were experienced, the less lethality was observed in these regions, and the fewer attacks were experienced on tribal leaders. This might be the case in the short run, but obviously these drone attacks can also lead to solidarity with the terrorist organization, so I'm not completely sure whether this is the case. And you see here in the figure in the bottom right is that there is a certain correlation between the drone strikes and the terrorist attacks overall within this particular country. So here, negative incentives through this preemptive strategy. What is also a strategy that is pursued by some actors, but not by all actors, is that one does not negotiate with terrorists. So this is the official doctrine of the Israel authorities. And then Brandt, George, and Sandler have analyzed here whether or not one should negotiate and they pay a ransom, the demanded ransom for these terrorists when they demand this particular ransom. And what they see is that the number of hostage incidents goes down if you do not pay the ransom. And here you see a difference between the behavior of the European Union and its member state governments and then the United States or Israel. Then obviously the hostages that are taken quite often, they are killed, but the insistence of not negotiating with the terrorist lowers obviously the incentive to ask then for or to kidnap other civilians. There are also studies which look then more at the positive incentives, foreign aid. This is a proactive strategy, and there is a study by two French authors, Jean-Paul Azam and his colleague, and they find that foreign aid, which you see here as ODA per capita, reduces in all the regressions that they run, models 4, 5, 6, and 7, that are reported here, reduces the number of terrorist events originating from the countries that are included in this particular analysis. What also helps is a strong welfare state, strong education system. There is a study by Brian Burgon, 2006, in the Journal of Conflict Resolution, and you see here how an increased size of social transfers reduces the exposure to transnational terrorism. The states have, after 9/11, increasingly engaged into counter-terrorism strategies. And this has then affected specific civil laws. So, for instance, you can distinguish between the impact on immigration laws, procedural rights that individuals have, for instance, foreigners in a host state, and then also privacy rights. And after 9/11, more or less all states have become more restrictive and have put constraints on privacy rights. And you see here a shift here across all states, a larger variance in 2000 in comparison to 2008. When you try to explain this econometrically, and then you see here the table in the bottom left, and you see here that when a state, for instance, has troops in Afghanistan, then this goes hand in hand with a reduction in privacy rights. And what is also playing a role, at least partly with regard to immigration rights, is whether or not you have left wing cabinet or not. So you see here on this slide that states have become more and more restrictive over time. You look here at immigration laws, procedural rights, privacy rights on all three dimension. OECD member states have introduced more restrictions to the detriment of their citizens. And what you also see here in this study by Epifanio is that you can explain these restrictions systematically. So, for instance, troops in Afghanistan play an important rule here, political orientation of the cabinet is important. And perhaps most interestingly, richer states are less likely than to become more restrictive here. Okay, these restrictions are obviously creating a trade-off. You want to be secure on the one hand, but you also want to have as much rights, as many rights as possible. Some of these rights might be symbolic for you, so most likely you're not affected directly, at least, by a ban, a potential ban on facial veils in cars, for instance, but you might be affected as social media users by data retention laws. So please think about this and discuss this in the tutorials on how far you want to go with these kind of restrictions. Is it worth the additional security that you might have gained?